Hi, I'm Vince Clark. You just met in the Rex Hotel.
I'm Andy Bell, and this is my voice.
Let's talk about all the things we don't want to talk about. Of course, the interview might be over before it starts.
No, we'll talk about anything. Anything apart from Michael Jackson's trial case. Yeah.
It was must have been incredibly fulfilling to have so many of these shows sell out in mere seconds. Whose idea was it to do multiple nights in many cities?
It was actually the idea of our... We have a project manager who's involved in this particular record, Nightbird, and he's also a PR person. And because, you know, we did another tour 2 years ago, he wanted to do something a bit different, you know, something that would attract a bit of attention from the press. So rather than doing one big venue, we do these multiple nights. And it's a chance for us to play in a different environment and actually get to see some faces.
Yeah, and I was going to actually follow up on that. Smaller venues, Andy, what's it like not to have the teeming hordes in front of you?
You kind of acclimatize yourself towards the audience. So it's a bit like being a goldfish, and you grow to the size of the bowl. So you kind of you get used to like maybe a 3,000 crowd or 2,000 crowd. So when it's quite tiny, like in San Francisco, the 500, it's kind of like can be more intimidating. The smaller the place can be more intimidating. At the same time, I hate playing cattle sheds because everyone's treated like dirt, and so it's kind of like it's trying to find a happy medium. And but I do love being part of the town, so it's kind of because you do feel like part of the town for a while, for part of the city.
And I read in an interview, what strange newspaper, the New Mexican, which it must have been in New Mexico, that you said that they're actually, when you play multiple nights, there tend to be different crowds on different nights, almost like they're club nights.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, we just did a run in New York of 10 nights, and it definitely seems to be a different audience. You know, even different races almost. Yeah. You know, it was really interesting. Sometimes it was couples, sometimes it was men only.
Yeah. Sometimes it's Asian night, sometimes it's old folks night.
So you've created your own club nights without even knowing you've created a club night.
I mean, tonight it's going to be is gay cop night tonight. And it wasn't arranged. We didn't arrange it. That's just the way the tickets fall out.
Do you really know that tonight's gay cop night?
Well, we were told.
I better park in the right place.
No.
I'm going to be in such trouble. I better play in the right place and pay in the right place, right?
Yeah.
Gay cop, I love, of all the answers, you never thought you were going to get to a question. Gay cop night is right there. And what a great segue. I would be remiss if I didn't ask about the theme and the costumes. I've read Brothers Grimm. I've heard a little bit of Rapture in there from of course, one of my favorite people. And I've heard a little Ave Maria. This is just some of the little things I've heard. So fill in a few blanks for me.
Well,
or have I just done it all?
Well, you've done a lot of it. I mean, with the set's based around an enchanted forest. So, and then we have a couple of warped Elvis Presleys, some Marilyn Monroe characters, and also the characters that you just mentioned. And the end of the
just
show...
Just another night for erasure.
Yeah, and the end of the show ends with Andy in his underpants, as usual.
We just had two...
For gay cop night especially.
Yeah, we had some woman was there from Reuters last night, the backing singers were telling me. And they said, well, who's the singer? You know, right? They said, well,
who's the singer?
His name's Andy Bell. She said, well, who's the guy playing keyboards? Right? So his name's Vincent Clark. She said, oh, how'd you spell it? So she's writing.
You sure this wasn't the NME that was there last night?
And then she goes, and who are the drag queens? Like about the singers? And she said, what, they're not men? And she couldn't believe it that they weren't men.
I obviously never been to San Francisco or Chelsea or anywhere.
People just don't know whatever's going on. You can tell your story and people still don't know, do they? No.
Okay, I don't believe, and maybe I'm really, really a rube from somewhere else. I'm going to do a Reuters question. I don't believe I've ever really known about the band name.
Well, I mean, at the end of the day, it was a word that we chose and it doesn't really mean anything. We just got the word from the film Eraserhead, I suppose.
It's from a list. We just have a list.
Okay, so now do you remember way back when some of the bands that could have been singing these songs? Some of the other names that could have...
Was Vince and Andy.
Vince, good one!
Yeah. Yaz 2. No.
Yaz 2. Yaz 2. How about just calling it Don't Go?
Nah, that'd be good. That'd be brilliant.
I think Don't Go is a good name for a band.
Yeah, that's really
good. You know
what
set you up right? No matter how bad the songs are, Don't Go.
Water Babies.
Which wouldn't have been very good.
Water Babies would have been would have given you a hold, but yeah. Just think of the sets and the costumes. What you could have done there. So it's going to sound like Henry Higgins, but Maine and Spain and lots of time on the computer has kind of made up Nightbird. So very different experience in two very separate lives. So tell me a little bit about the process.
Well, Andy visited me in New York, and we spent 6 or 8 weeks writing the songs. And that we do that very simply with just guitar and a tape recorder. Work out the melodies and the arrangements and the chord structures. And then because Andy lives in Spain and England, I live in the States, we were exchanging arrangement ideas via the internet. And then I was also working with a programmer called John Collier in London. So I might send John an idea for a rhythm pattern, he might come back with a bass pattern. And we've all got the same studio set up in each city. So we could recreate.
Oh, terrific!
So you could add. It's like someone writing a story, and someone contributes a chapter, and then it just gets built that way.
You see, and it's so funny because you've been such a technological band since day one. So this all just kind of falls into a lot of the ways that you've thought from moment one.
Well, it's a great way of working because it means that you can work on whatever you're inspired to work on the beginning of the day. You know, it's not like you're working on one track.
You're not in the studio and stuck with the producer saying, okay, now.
Today we're doing this track or that track. You know,
and motivated, yeah.
No, if you have an idea, you know, something might occur to you in the middle of the night for track two, then you can go down and do it and I can just send it to Andy. And then we built the tracks out that way. And then once we had all the parts arranged, then we all got together in London to actually mix the thing in real time.
Now, a lot of the newer bands, which we'll talk about in a little while, have started out with software synths. That's all they know. This was new.
Yes, new to me.
Yes. So what was that like? Tell me a little bit about coming into the 2000s.
Well, it was, I kind of was forced to do it because I moved to America and I couldn't bring my studio with me. Well, not yet anyway. So all I had was my Mac. And I was actually forced to sit down and read manuals for the first time.
Oh no, not manuals.
Yeah, I learned some new technology. So for me, it was really good. I mean, I wouldn't have done it otherwise had I not been forced to do it, you know. And I think actually now I'm kind of getting into it and it's very, very exciting. It's really cool.
Among the gazillion names, Scissor Sisters, Fisher Spooner, Return of New Order. I don't think pop music, at least my opinion, ever went away. But many are trying to call all of this a comeback, which is a great opportunity for people who haven't discovered Erasure, which seemingly you would think that impossible with, you know, 20 million albums or whatever the number would be. But the whole young crowd that is coming to you through Fisher Spooner or the Scissor Sisters, what do you think about that? Kind of neat, huh?
Well, it's I think definitely people are more interested in melody now. I think that's true. You know, I think
why did it go away for a while there?
Because I think the whole dance scene kind of took over, and people there more interested in ecstasy and repetitiveness, and people weren't that interested in songs. And I think that the guys, the DJs that were pushing synthesizers in that field now have come around to the idea of writing tunes. I don't think people are really harking back to the 80s or anything. I think actually these are new people coming through.
I mean, there's a bit of a thing as well in the UK at the moment where they're just taking samples from like a Hall & Oates song or and looping it, which kind of gets on your nerves with like a crushed guitar, rhythm guitar sound, which is kind of, I've heard it here already, but it's already old at home. It probably lasts about a year, you know.
The world doesn't need this. And yet you said you wanted Nightbird to sound like a synthesizer record. You know, no real sounds, and so, I mean, it's really interesting because people do go out of their way to say, did you put a real guitar on that record? And why would they go out of their way of all the bands that you could possibly ask these questions? Why is this even relevant when the music is so completely, you know, ingrained in everybody at this point?
I mean, I think that you can, you know, when more records you make, the harder it is to be kind of naive in the way that you approach the music, you know. I think the great thing about the electroclash scene that happened in New York was that it was really, I mean, I heard stuff and I thought I was really impressed by it, but it's stuff that I couldn't do myself again, even though I know exactly how it's done. You kind of, you know, you get to a point.
It's going back.
well, it's not even going backwards because it's still very, very exciting.
Right.
But it's just, you know, you
it's not naive.
It's not, yeah, you're not naive and it's not new to you,
mm-hmm.
I think. Yeah, and also, I mean, it'll be almost like kind of talking in a way that a baby talks, suddenly going back to that because it was really plain speaking,
mm-hmm.
you know, not using long words.
I mean, I don't know. I mean, I love writing with Vince. It's great writing with Vince. And I think we've got loads more songs in us to come out. Probably at least another 100, because we've done 100 or more.
So to get away from the music just on a serious note, particularly since we're in San Francisco, I played and actually read a AIDS Walk public service announcement, and I commented on the fact that a lot of people have this perception that it's been solved. The people really have a perception that this is a disease that's been, you know, that we've got the medicines, we can keep people alive, but I wanted to just hear your input on that a little bit, because you certainly are, you know for a fact it has not been solved.
No, it's not solved. It's kind of like, I don't know, you kind of feel like you're on a waiting list a bit kind of thing, and kind of waiting for a cure, which you don't know whether there ever will be. So you're kind of, and at the same time, there are people that don't believe in the drugs, in taking the drugs, who have survived. And my boyfriend, when he found out he was positive in 1990, he lived without taking any drugs for 10 years until he had a stroke. So then he had a stroke, and he
said, "I better do something."
T cells went to zero or whatever, and then he had to do something. He had no choice. And then, then there are the generic drugs, which now they can sell in Africa thank God for people, but only about 2% of the population have access to them. So, you know, it's really a disaster waiting to happen there, unless they can, you know, we need to manufacture drugs for them. Let alone them making their own versions of them. We need to export and not charge them for them.
A lot of work to be done.
A lot of work to be done.
Maybe it's just me who sat there watching Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind and listening to Beck sing Everybody's Gotta Learn Sometime, and I turn to my friend and I say, well, you know, Erasure covered that on other people's songs, and of course we're in America here, where that album was certainly, and one other one was not even released here, which I was listening to on the way and play on my show on a regular basis. So I don't want to really get into the ups and downs, but here you are, and you're selling out like mad, and I don't think the audience ever went away. I think that music had to go through some, I don't want to say bad times, but maybe non-melodic times, you know, noise, to get back here, but of course a great melody always provides. So tell me a little bit about, you know, choosing, say, the Corgis, you know, because you didn't pick the obvious songs for that album, and perhaps that's why people got a little bit, you know, Walking in the Rain, maybe people kind of said, now what are they doing here? And, you know, but it was very brave to pick, you know, because that song was big, I think, over in England, but over here it was non-existent. I mean, I played it, but what do I know, you know? I'm a melodic boy, so tell me what you think.
Well, I mean, the songs were chosen from lists, again, you know, myself. I mean, it was going to be like a side project for both. For Andy started it with Gareth Jones, in fact.
Mm-hmm.
He went to do an album of Phil Spector songs. And then I managed to get my way in there. And then it ended up with us making lists of our favourite songs that we wanted to record and try.
That you would never even attempt.
Yeah. Well, yeah, and we did it at my...
Spell sales disaster, ladies and gentlemen.
We did it at my studio, and it was done on the cheap, you know. And it was just a side project. And it, you know,
But you see, everybody takes everything so seriously. And I think the greatest thing about what you do... I mean, as I was listening to music, and I purposely, you know, I was listening to the hits... I first put in the hits, but then I just started picking tracks. And every single song has what in rock and roll we call a riff. Every song has a defining melody to it. And this is what great songwriters like King and Goffin and, you know, and Phil Spector and everybody else, you know, it was obviously ingrained in you automatically, and it's there in every single song. So then when you turn around and you have some fun, the reviewers come out and say, how dare they do this? How dare they have fun? But the whole idea of Erasure is fun.
Well,
I mean, you sing love songs, for crying out loud, mostly, you know.
No, I think Clark and Bell has a really good ring to it anyway, just,
mm-hmm.
you know, Clark
right.
and Bell.
Right.
So, and it sounds like quality. We did a version of Magic Moments. It was
that was on a Clive Barker movie called Lord of Illusion, which when there's the most horrific murder scene happens, and then they play Magic Moments, our version. And then also in this new movie called Debs, apparently, they sing A Little Respect. They're kind of miming along to A Little Respect, the main character in the film, but we haven't seen it yet. I haven't seen Lord of Illusions either, so.
What do you think, Vince? If we had to pick a movie that we want to put an erasure track under, what would be a good scene to, you know, Vince and Andy, what do you think?
I would think...
Maybe we can make this happen.
Siren Song would be a beautiful, kind of like a shipwreck movie scene.
Titanic 6.
Yeah, it's literal.
I don't know. I think
I'm looking to start a campaign here.
No. Maybe Yola, Moore and John Wayne movie.
Yeah. Now, could you imagine him with the gun shooting and that comes, the riff comes, that would really be, them going, the horses going over the hill and that comes on and it's just. Andy, I read one of your favorite songwriters is Paul Simon, and I heard him recently on NPR and he described the absolute pain and torture and methodology and insanity he goes through for a song to come out. Should songwriting really be painful or joyful?
Well, I think, again, it's that part of you get a bit older and you can't go back to writing simple songs. It's very difficult. I mean, Paul Simon writes very sophisticated melodies and chord structures now. And I can imagine that it's a torture for him.
So I have an almost 4-year-old daughter, and right now she's dancing to A Little Respect, but I know that there's this other thing that is coming out hopefully soon with some nursery rhymes involved. So tell me a little bit about the acoustic project, because I've read a lot about it.
There are two, actually. There are two projects.
Two different projects, right.
One acoustic project, and the nursery rhyme is project. So we're just taking traditional nursery rhymes and fairy tales and is singing them or narrating them. And we're kind of exaggerating the twistedness of the lyrics of those nursery rhymes.
Uh-oh. It will be okay for my daughter to live? Well, she watches some pretty amazing stuff in this day and age, so.
Should be all right.
Yeah, I mean, yeah. I'd like it to sound quite right. Scary.
Yeah, but it's very soothing.
You know what? There's so much scary stuff on TV for kids, it doesn't matter.
Yeah.
So when are these due to appear? Because I know that there's certainly a lot of anticipation and excitement.
Well, the acoustic record, which is another project, that's going to be released hopefully at the beginning of next year. And then the nursery rhyme project, we're right doing that at the moment, so probably towards the end of next year.
So back to the acoustic for a second. What songs, and I want you both to kind of talk about this, what songs were the toughest and what songs were you just blown away how incredibly lovely they came stripped down?
Well, actually, they were all easy.
They had a melody in the first place. They were written as melody.
Yeah, and they were written with guitar as well. So we were only bringing them back to how they were. And it was great because we were working with a bunch of really good musicians from Brooklyn. And, you know, it was they weren't overly complicated songs. Andy re-sang all the songs. And, they just suited the acoustic instruments, I think.
They sound like Billie Holiday or something like that.
Can't go wrong with that.
Yeah, I really enjoyed singing them because it's kind of just a different space for singing.
Did you think of them any differently?
Well, you kind of.
Did you not pound them out as intensely, or?
Because you don't pound them out at all, and I think by that time, I was kind of digging deeper anyway. You know, and you're kind of trying to sing through the soles of your feet. Mm-hmm. So, and also my voice is a bit deeper and stuff, so.
So it's changed a little bit.
Yeah.
So the last thing that I like to do, and this is really kind of joyful, you know, I like to build a musical sandwich. And what that sandwich is your songs as the bread. So a couple of your songs as the bread. And then in the middle, and I will send you a copy at Mute because I have gone out and found, I can't even tell you where I've had to travel to find the music, but I haven't failed yet. Whatever someone tells me to put in between the bread, I have played and segued exactly as they've asked it for. Oh, he's looking like, I want to do this.
No.
Off the top of your head, give me some stuff to fill up the next portion of this lovely chat that we've had.
I don't know. I don't know which choices for our songs. I mean, maybe you can choose those.
How kind of you. I bet he'll have something for me, but...
Well, I would love to hear a sandwich with us with a track Calling All Boys by The Flirts.
Oh, I love The Flirts.
Yeah, so...
Of course.
Yeah. one of those.
To play them in the clubs all the time. How about a couple other tunes? What else?
Something else.
Okay.
Oh, you're going to have to contribute.
Frank Sinatra by Miss Kittin.
Four in Paris or something like that.
A track by Milo called Paris Four. Mm-hmm. It's the first track on the album.
Okay. Come on, Vince, give me a couple of tunes.
Well, let's do Plastic Age by the Buggles.